Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, One Land, Many Voices, we hear a talk by Remy Kanazi, a Palestinian-American performance poet and human rights activist who spoke at Portland State University on divestment on school campuses. At 10, it's Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Flashpoints. At 11, Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher hosts a panel discussion with presenters from the Mathematics Education and Society Conference, a biennial international conference being held this week at Portland State University, exploring social, political, cultural, and ethical dimensions of mathematics education. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. You are listening to it. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 2nd through 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. Four stages, 100 performers, including the Greg Allman Band, Galactic with Macy Gray, and Buddy Guy. There will be after-hours performances, shows on the Portland Spirit, and much more. Again, that's the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Thursday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm/waterfrontbluesfestival2015.
I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down, for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot fail.
Who are part of SUPER here at PSU, Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. So we want to thank you all for coming to hear Remy talk about divestment on school campuses and also recite some of his spoken word. A little bit about Remy, poet, writer, and activist based in New York City, editor of Poets for Palestine. Political commentary has been featured by news outlets throughout the world, including Al Jazeera English, Grit TV with Laura Flanders and BBC Radio. His poetry has taken him across North America, the UK, and the Middle East. He recently appeared in the Palestine Festival of Literature, as well as Poetry International. He is a reoccurring writer in residence and advisory board member for the Palestinian Writing Shop. So with that, Remy Kanazi.
So basically, I'm going to do a 20-minute talk on BDS, on divestment, what it is, why Palestinians are calling for it. I'm on the organizing committee for the U.S. campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel, but we're going to be talking about campus action today. And so I'll talk maybe for like 20 minutes, do a poem in there, so that'll actually be like 24 minutes, and then perform for half an hour and not go on longer than that, because then you'll want to boycott and divest from me. You know, I'm going to talk a lot about settler colonialism and occupation and apartheid overseas, but this isn't something that we have to go overseas to see, right? We, too, on this continent are a settler colonial state. We have the continued expropriation of native land and resources, right? There was the execution of Mike Brown in Ferguson and the continued brutalization of the Ferguson community. I live in New York City, where 5 million people under Michael Bloomberg were stopped and frisked. You have racist drug laws, mandatory minimums, the U.S.-Mexico border, millions of of people who have been kicked out over the last 6 years, and millions more on the U.S.-Mexico border. So very much when we talk about U.S. militarism overseas or Israeli occupation, apartheid, and ethnic cleansing, it's not to discount or to look away from militarism within our own backyard and those manifestations of racism. So in the same breath that you're condemning the drone bombing of Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, or occupation apartheid, we're also standing against anti-black racism in the United States, or transphobia and homophobia in our local communities, sexual violence on college campuses. What binds socially conscious people together is working against systems of injustice. So whether it's a super or an SJP, Palestinian rights or justice are the operative words and phrases. And so it's something important to keep in mind, even when we're talking about divestment, because it's not about a singular focus, it's about a system of oppression. So what is the BDS call? BDS quite literally stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. So in 2005, Palestinian civil society, more than 170 civil society groups, from trade unions to women's organizations to academic, religious, and cultural institutions, called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the state of Israel until it complied with three basic demands. Number one, ending the occupation of all Arab land. So you have millions of Palestinians that remain under occupation and also the Syrian Golan Heights. Number two, the right of return for Palestinian refugees. So 750,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed in 1948. 531 villages were destroyed. Waves of ethnic cleansing have taken place throughout. And number three, equality for all Palestinians living inside of the State of Israel who face more than 50 laws that systematically discriminate against them in terms of labor, education, marriage, and so forth. So to give you just a quick example of one of the discriminatory... Mic check. Okay. One example of some of the discriminatory laws. Let's say you are a Palestinian living in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, and you marry a Palestinian living in Haifa, which is now part of the State of Israel. Under the family reunification law, you can't be with your spouse in Haifa simply because you're not Jewish. And so when you look at the rhetoric that's used around this, they talk about, quote, a demographic threat, right? And what does that essentially mean? It means that there are too many Palestinian babies and they're watering down the, quote, purity of the state. Now, in the beginning, when they had this temporary order put in place, Israel said it was for security measures. But more lawmakers have been a little more candid over the last few years, and they said that it's about demographic realities. It's about we don't want to be flooded with Palestinians. So, yeah, racism. That sucks. So these three basic demands are in line with international law, as problematic as international law can be as a tool of colonialism. But it's in line with international law, countless UN resolutions, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Geneva Conventions. So it's basically a positive, ethical, anti-racist, and most importantly, effective call to challenge Israeli occupation, apartheid, and ethnic cleansing. So the question that comes up is, you know, why did Palestinians decide on BDS? Why not another measure? Well, after 10 years of failed peace negotiations, the doubling of settlements and outposts, the further decimation of the Palestinian economy, further restriction of travel, 1.8 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip relegated to an open-air prison, the demolition of homes, 27,000 since 1967, the further restriction of life within East Jerusalem, and new draconian laws inside of the State of Israel, Palestinian civil society decided it was time to act. No longer were they waiting on a dishonest broker in the United States, a silent or colluding European Union, the collaborating Arab states, or an action by the rest of the world, but it was time for a popular civil rights-based approach calling on people conscience around the world to cut their complicity with apartheid and occupation and stand with an oppressed people. To quote from the BDS call, inspired by the struggle of South Africans against apartheid and in the spirit of international solidarity, moral consistency, and resistance to injustice and oppression, we call for BDS. So some people say, well, why not peace negotiations? The recent round of peace negotiations, I think, was an important marker for understanding why they aren't the avenue that Palestinian civil society is choosing. For the first time, and off the record, American negotiators were strikingly and anomalously clear. They said that settlements were the main obstacle in destruction of the recent round of peace negotiations. This is what a couple people said off the record. People in Israel shouldn't ignore the bitter truth. The primary sabotage came from the settlements. During that period of so-called peace negotiations, 14,000 illegal housing units in the West Bank and East Jerusalem were approved. So what is divestment? On your campus, the way that it functions is that your university invests in companies. Unfortunately, some of those companies are engaged in human rights abuses. So what students groups, and whether it's Super or Students for Justice in Palestine, will say to the administration or your student council or through a referendum vote is that we don't want our tuition and endowment dollars investing in companies profiting off of oppression. So to give you a quick example, take Caterpillar. Now, Caterpillar sends over armored and D9 militarized bulldozers to the Israeli state. Those bulldozers are used to bulldoze Palestinian homes. As I mentioned before, 27,000 homes since 1967, uproot Palestinian olive trees, so a form of basic sustenance for Palestinians, over a million uprooted since 1967, and kill American citizens like Rachel Corrie. We're close enough to Olympia, Washington. The Corrie family's out there doing really brilliant work. Or you think of HP. So in the United States, a lot of people think of printers or hard drives or ink cartridges. But HP also sends over biometric technology to the state of Israel that's used at checkpoints deep within the West Bank to segregate Palestinians. They also operate in settlements. And the technology that they send over is also used to enhance the naval blockade on the Gaza Strip. Now, many of these companies don't just oppress Palestinians, and that's going to be a theme of the night. When you look at HP, HP also works with ICE and the Department of Homeland Security. G4S, which we were just talking about before, operates in prisons and imprisons Palestinians, but also operates in prisons in the United States, in South Africa, in the UK. When you look at companies like Elbit Systems, Elbit Systems manufactures drones, works with the academy inside of the state of Israel to brutalize the Palestinian people, but also works on the U.S.-Mexico border. Or take an example like Lev Leviev, who's been infamous for settlement building within the West Bank, but through his company, Africa Israel, is also involved in diamond mining in Angola. So like divestment from the prison industrial complex or fossil fuels or challenging sweatshops, SJPs and allied groups and supers, SJP, there's different acronyms. There's SIA, there's SPHR, but, you know, you're all cool. They're targeting specific corporations who are profiting off of specific human rights abuses. That is fair, ethical, and has a long, rich history on U.S. campuses and throughout the world. But the next question comes up because some people say, well, you know, we can't have BDS, and we'll kind of get into that, and particularly we can't have divestment on college campuses. But the question is, if not divestment, then what? If we all agree that Israel's in violation of international law, we'll talk about that some more later, which is supported by the UN, countless UN resolutions, and a multitude of human rights organizations, that settlements are wrong, that decades of military occupation is untenable, that depriving millions of people freedom and equality is unconscionable, then what? What are we going to do about it? Our words will not tear down apartheid walls. Right-wing dialogue projects don't stop settlements from expanding. Discussing hurt feelings in the U.S. doesn't stop the next bomb from dropping. We need positive and swift action, not reaffirmation of the status quo. We must act where governments have failed. We must respond to Palestinian civil society. We must cut our direct lines of complicity. Now, it's important to say that America is not a silent actor. We are not silent actors. It's the U.S. government that gives $3.4 billion a year in military aid to Israel. It's U.S. government that sends over Apache helicopters and Hellfire missiles and cluster bombs that are used against a civilian population in an open-air prison. It's the U.S. government that axes Israel's veto inside of the U.N. and protects her throughout the world. Palestinians are not victims in need of aid. They're an occupied people in need of freedom. And our tax dollars, our government actions, our community investments, and our campus investments are standing in the way of that freedom. Now, you'll often hear, like, Israel apologists incessantly rebuke divestment and boycott to point to the tactic as radical, to act as if boycotts and divestments are, you know, divestment is something that Palestinians invented. But these positions are simply repackaged from other right-wing anti-action campaigns. The Chicago teacher union strike will hurt the city. The Montgomery bus boycott will hurt workers. Egyptians rising up for their rights will smash the economy. Black South Africans will be crushed by BDS, and on and on. It's important to note that whether we're talking about divestment or BDS generally, it's not about the starvation of a people or a banning of medicine. It's not like sanctions on Iraq during the 1990s, which starved to death over 600,000 children under the age of five. Rather, it is a call from the oppressed. It is a call from Palestinian civil society. It is a call from those who will also be affected by boycotts and divestment, just as black South Africans were, but they have called for it, knowing that necessary pressure is needed after governments and institutions have failed to act or actively collaborate in the subjugation of Palestinians. I talked about this before. The Palestinian people, it's about oppression, right? Like, whether we're standing against militarism at home or abroad, it's about fighting against systems of injustice. The Palestinians aren't more deserving of freedom or rights than anyone else. It's to say that no people should live under occupation. No people should face apartheid. No people should see their families ethnically cleansed. Every single person in this room needs to act, simply because your university investments are profiting off of crimes of humanity. You remain complicit. So let's talk about some of the talking points through a poem. So I'm a poet. Yay. How much do I got left? Okay. Let's do this one through a poem. So this poem is called "This Divestment Bill Hurts My Feelings." Now, basically, like, when we talk about divestment on campus, people will be like, you know, "This divestment bill hurts my feelings. You're being divisive. Why are you singling Israel out? Whiny, 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 sh-." I'm going to address that in the poem. Now, it's actually done in two, I think it's like, you should be fun and happy anti-racist, and you shouldn't be, like, afraid to call people out, like, as long as you're standing with moral consistency. It'll be done in two voices. The first voice is, like, the super SJP me voice. I mean, I'm being 33, so I feel like a double PhD. And the other voice is the anti-divestment, we gotta keep investing in oppression voice. That voice is you should not be that voice. We will talk about throughout the night why you should change your position if that is the horrible position you currently hold. All right, then I'm gonna awkwardly finish up my talk and then do some love poems. And by love poems, I mean like angry about Palestine. This divestment bill, it hurts my feelings. That caterpillar bulldozer ended life in the body of an American citizen, drove her bones into the ground while a company cashed in on the sale. The claws of D9 bulldozers unearthed the livelihood of occupied Palestinians, uprooting their graveyards to make way for illegal settlements. But we need a positive campus climate. While HP stock rises on division, producing technology to segregate Palestinians, biometric IDs at checkpoints, enhancing the naval blockade of an open-air prison, Palestinians on campus listen to words like positive, climate, hurt feelings, knowing their tuition invests in companies raining terror on loved ones. That's suffering. Like, their voices is non-existent to student board members looking for cushy jobs at top five law firms. But this divestment bill, it's divisive. The Montgomery bus boycott, divisive. The Great Boycott, one-sided. Abolishing slavery, radical. Nelson Mandela, a terrorist. Indigenous, savages, women's suffrage, complicated. Desegregation, provocative. Hiroshima security, internment camps necessity, Bantustan autonomy, Iraq liberation, Palestine barren. There is always going to be an excuse. Catchphrases, talking points, strip away names and faces. We are being militant, unreasonable. There is context to this oppression. The word apartheid makes you feel uncomfortable. It's apartheid by definition. Fits the 73 Convention. By law, it is a crime against humanity. Two sets of laws for two people. Labor, land ownership, access to education. 46 years of occupation. 27,000 homes demolished. Nearly a million arrests since 67. Whoa. No one said Israel doesn't have problems. But why are they singling out on campuses? You mean like Darfur? Tibet? South Africa? Sweatshops? Coca-Cola? Animal testing? The Keystone Pipeline? The prison industrial complex? Fossil fuels? Teacher unions? University cuts? And bottled water? The real question, why are you singling out any injustice for protection? Let me get the next one for you. Israel is democratic. Democratic like coal is clean, Miller Lite is the same great taste, less filling, and McDonald's salads are healthy. These are not imagined scenarios. Our tuition dollars are profiting off of debt. Divestment is the next step. This is not about a nation or a people, but what's being done to people in our names, with our currency. This university will not liberate anyone, but it can choose to cease making a buck off of misery. Vote yes for divestment. No to appeasement. Affirming injustice isn't positive for any kind. Boom. So let's take on just a few more of the talking points on divestment before we wrap up. Now, people say, like, another frame of, you know, divestment is divisive. If we've actually looked at the coalitions that have formed on college campuses, or the fact that dozens of organizations on campus after campus have endorsed, or the fact that thousands of students have come out in support, the opposite of divisive has happened. Students have come together and fruitful conversation has begun on challenging systems of oppression and cutting direct lines of complicity. Now people will say, even after my lovely poem, which is weird, Israel is being singled out. And it's true. Israel is being singled out. With aid, weapons, and UN vetoes in their favor. No other country in the world is as singled out by America than Israel. We are simply asking for that singling out to stop, for Israel to be taken off the pedestal and treated like any other country. And the reality is this, we don't give $3.4 billion a year in military aid to the Sudan. We don't have preferential trade agreements with Syria, and we don't call North Korea a democracy. Furthermore, as I stated in the poem, Israel is not the only violator of human rights, nor is it the only target. From occupation in Palestine to sweatshops to exploitation of labor, it is essential that we stand against all ethical investments. Now, California professor George Bacharet summed up the talking point of other countries having worse human rights records. And he said this. There's never been a worst first rule for boycotts. Activists urging divestment from apartheid South Africa were not racist because they failed to simultaneously condemn the demonstrably worse Cambodian dictator Pol Pot. Nor were U.S. civil rights protesters required to inventory the world and only protest if our nation exceeded the abuse of others. Boycotts are justified whenever they are necessary and promise results. In the case of Israel, not only is divestment justified, not only are we the most complicit, not only is it a call from the oppressed, but it's an effective tactic. This is why Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in his last APEC speech, spent over a third of it talking about boycott, divestment, and sanctions. This is why the Reut Institute, which is an Israeli think tank, talked about BDS being one of the top forms of delegitimization. Now, it's not about delegitimizing a religion or a people, but about a system of oppression. And I think many people have done a splendid job, so good job. There isn't a single sector of Israeli society, from the media to think tanks, that doesn't fear BDS as a tactic. Now, I work on cultural boycott. If an artist, like the Flock of Seagulls, or some other band that hasn't had a hit since 1988, goes over to play in Tel Aviv, part of a Brand Israel project to rebrand Israel as this liberal, enlightened state in a similar way that South Africa used Sun City in the 1970s and 80s. If they're going over and playing a gig, like, Israel acts like John Lennon came back from the dead and is, like, blessing a stadium in Tel Aviv. Just to give you a little bit of an idea. So, why are they all afraid of it? Because it's a positive action. Because it has historic precedent, it challenges the status quo, and it's picking up steam. It's also essential to remember that many of these anti-divestment talking points aren't new. The propaganda was used during the anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s. It was Jerry Falwell in debate with Jesse Jackson on Nightline back in 1985, that basically said if you have boycotts and divestments against South Africa, you are going to starve 1 to 2 million South African, black South Africans. He also said, why are you singling out South Africa for divestment when you look around the African continent, there are much worse human rights abusers. It was Ed Koch in 1985 in New York City, the mayor of the city I now live in, that said, why are you singling out South Africa for divestment? Now, we tend to romanticize the fall of apartheid in South Africa, and many ignore today's struggles, but it's imperative to note that calls for boycotts and divestment came out in the 1950s. It wasn't until 1986 that UC California divested more than $3 billion worth of investments in South Africa and the apartheid apparatus, which Nelson Mandela credited in terms of the international anti-apartheid struggle in pushing things forward. Without getting into how patronizing and shameful this next talking point is, you cannot claim to be pro-Palestine and anti-divestment. It's like the equivalent of a white person in the Jim Crow South saying, I'm pro-African-American rights, but I'm anti-Montgomery bus boycott. I'm anti-South African apartheid, but I'm literally against any effective tool challenging that system of apartheid. If you are anti-divestment, you are taking an active stance in favor of university complicity with crimes against humanity. Investing in apartheid, occupation, and oppression is not a neutral stance. And this is for those who say, you know, well, I want to feel safe on campus. I absolutely agree. Every person has the right to feel safe on campus. Every person has the right to an opinion. You have zero right to profit off of oppression. And that's what we're talking about here. Now, to wrap up, it's critical to note that divestment exists outside of this room. We've seen divestment campaigns at UCLA and UC Santa Barbara, UC Berkeley, UC Santa Cruz, and Michigan and Massachusetts and Arizona, a couple brilliant recent campaigns at Loyola University and DePaul University. And new campaigns are sprouting up as we speak. But we have to also look at divestment within the greater context. We've seen BDS victories in terms of TIA CREF, the country's largest pension fund, divesting $72 million from Caterpillar in its social life fund, to St. Louis dropping Veolia, a French company that worked on the Jerusalem Light Rail line and ran segregated buses in the West Bank. We've seen more than 1,000 academics sign on to academic boycott. We've seen academic associations take up academic boycott, from the Asian American Studies Association to the American Studies Association to the Native American and Indigenous Scholars Association to the African Literature Association and the Critical Ethnic Studies Association. On the cultural boycott front, we've seen more than 500 artists alone in Montreal sign on to cultural boycott, 370 in the U.S., 240 in Ireland, 140 in Switzerland, and campaigns continue to sprout up. We've seen outward support from Pink Floyd frontman Roger Waters, Nine Inch Nails, Angela Davis, Alice Walker, and many others. We've seen the cancellation of gigs by people like Elvis Costello and Bono and Santana and Bjork and the Claxons, the Pixies, the Gorillaz, Vanessa Paradis, Dustin Hoffman, Meg Ryan, and a lot of other folks in different sectors of music and art. What? Stevie Wonder. Stevie Wonder pulled out of the Friends of the IDF dinner out in L.A. And And for me, for like the younger generation, Talib Kweli pulled out of his gig a few months ago and has been saying awesome stuff about Palestine and came out with a track with M1 from Dead Prez and has been super supportive. You know, so it's important to also recognize that we're reaching beyond the choir. And this goes back to kind of like linking oppressions. Now, some of the same folks that were pushing for divestment at UCLA were also pushing for divestment from the prison industrial complex there. When you saw the divestment vote last year at UCLA, you saw the African student chairs, you saw South Asian students, you saw queer students, you saw the Armenian Students Association and other folks coming out in favor of divestment. When you looked at UC Santa Barbara, where they pushed forward a motion on divestment, some of the same students were pushing for a motion in solidarity with undocumented folks and undocumented rights on campuses. I was supposed to do a BDS town hall at Washington University. Local and campus Zionists got really afraid, and then a lot of things ensued. We ended up having an alternative event, but that's another story maybe for the Q&A. But the same folks that brought me out were some of the same folks doing an overnight sit-in against Peabody Energy, and I think some of the students got arrested. The same folks that brought me out for a BDS workshop at Rutgers University were doing a sit-in against Condoleezza Rice giving the commencement speech. A Chicano organizer down in Arizona who was fighting for divestment from companies profiting off of apartheid was also working against racist laws like SB 1070. So you're seeing more connection and more challenging of different forms of oppression and companies that are profiting not just in Palestine, but elsewhere. So students don't simply care about Palestine. They're challenging human rights and human rights abusers across the board. Coalitions are being built, and energy from one campaign is being transferred to another. As I said in the poem, this is not about a nation or a people, but what's being done to people in our names, with our resources. No one has the right. Nobody has the right to make a buck off of misery. No university should be collaborating with systems of oppression, and divesting is the very least that we can do. Now, Israel has millions of dollars in PR. It has well-funded groups in the United States acting on its behalf. Right-wing Zionist organizations are sending out anti-divestment talking points to pro-Israel students. They're sending student senators on all paid trips to Israel on propaganda trips. They're flying out members of the Israeli army to challenge divestment on campus. They're flying out paid representatives to coach students and bully administrations and SJP. So those calling for freedom, justice, and equality are out-resourced and out-funded. So why are we winning? Why is the tide turning? Why are more universities divesting and more communities boycotting? Because of one simple fact. We have truth and history on our side, and that has no price tag. Martin Luther King once famously proclaimed, "Freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed." Palestinians had made their demands clear. The time for action is now. Standing for complicity and on the wrong side of history is a shameful position to be in. Vote yes for divestment, no to appeasement. Affirming injustice isn't positive for any climate. So just to like let you know like a little bit about myself, my name is Remy Kanazi. I grew up in a small town in Western Massachusetts. Now, there were about 9,000 people in the town that I grew up in. Of the 9,000 people in that town, I would say about 8,990 of them were white. Then there was my brown family, and we got like a Cambodian family in the 8th grade. On top of that, I had this thing called a Palestinian mother. Now, this Palestinian mother was very proud to be Palestinian. What scared the living out of all the white children in the neighborhood is that she was really proud of being Palestinian in public. Now this is where it gets a little bit awkward. I was a fat brown one eyebrow child going to Catholic school. That was an awkward cluster of emotions. What does this have to do with the first poem that I'm going to do? Nothing, but sharing is caring. I like the Care Bears, so I thought I would share that with you. I'm going to do this poem first because it's not about Palestine. I feel like we've done a lot of Palestine. I moved to New York City 4 months before 9/11. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but I have two eyebrows now, or at least 1.5. Not that I'm locking one eyebrow, some people look sexy with it. Me, it's like caterpillars just angrily running across my face and fighting with each other. Now, when those two towers came down, there was a lot of vitriolic language. There was that, we gotta go and turn that place into a parking lot. We gotta nuke them and start over. And a lot of folks didn't think I was Arab. They thought I was Italian. So they said incredibly racist around me. So this goes into the first poem that I'm going to do called Before the Machetes Are Raised. After 9/11, there was this systematic dehumanization of the Arab and Muslim male. This is something that had happened long before to the black and Latino male, and before that to the indigenous male. And there's this kind of concept where if 17 people die in Afghanistan tomorrow, it's not really a big deal, because they're in the Taliban. Or they're friends with the Taliban. Or one time they saw this YouTube video, and it said Taliban on it, so we bombed the living out of their neighborhood, killed 17 people, and whittled them down to best-case scenario statistics and numbers. And when you can whittle people down to statistics and numbers, it is so much easier to drop that bomb, to pull that trigger, and to occupy that village. Now, I realize that, this piece is written in a very kind of specific tone after a very specific period, and we have the other end of the spectrum, where there's this kind of decentralizing of trans women of color, of voices that you know, so even as a brown person in this kind of, like, cisgender space, there's still a prominence of that role. But this piece particularly was speaking about anti-Arab and anti-Muslim racism post 9/11. I'm disgusted by terrorism. Backwards animals who have no value for human life produce propaganda videos that disseminate their message, prey on the weakest in society, infect children, recruit fighters like expendable ants in the ideological struggle. You know who I'm talking about. Soldiers who drop bunker-busting bombs on mosques and universities, decry the Middle East, but follow authority closer than dictatorial rule, think stripes and codes rather than decency and humanity give them worth in this world. I've seen one too many Facebook invites by jingoistic kids I went to high school and grade school with. They couldn't wait to get in some trigger time, hunt down towel heads and hajis like venison. And when some Marines grenade launcher catapults 120 mini bombs per minute, takes out 17 houses and 14 schoolgirls, I'm supposed to feel bad that he can't see his wife and daughter on Christmas, respect his service when he comes back to the States, a murderer who destroyed a country full of daughters and wives that'll never see Eid. We're so quick to honor the troops, but don't dare mention the widows. The trembling father crying, immersed in his wife's charred flesh, a fetus blown out of her stomach. The soldier said, kicking down the door was too risky. Where's the love for the 25-year-old Iraqi man whose car was riddled with American-made bullets, pained face and surprised look like grabbing for sky, falling out of 110-story towers? As long as we don't affect our we'll shout out Darfur, Rwanda, and the need for antiretrovirals. Look at human beings as aid packages who can't compete. Rather than ravaged lands perfecting paradigms of imperialism and propaganda, where is that right-wing Zionist trying to save the Congo, combating Leviathan in Angola, genocide in northern Uganda? Where's the humanity before the machetes are raised and proxy forces put into place? King, Mandela, and Gandhi aren't meant to be easy reference platitudes to make you feel better at night, help you forget that uncomfortable poem Americans don't want to face. We'll worship American idols, but have no value for human life. And yet all I hear are 20-somethings telling me they just aren't in the politics. I wonder what they'd say at their parents' eulogy after they were blown up into 386 different pieces. I'm sure they wouldn't discuss things because politics isn't their thing. Politics isn't our thing. While we reach out for freedom and justice, we're defined as political to undermine our suffering, create notions of two sides and equal conflict, cover up our dispossession and burn down villages. We're political. So you can ignore us, delegitimize and forget us. But we're human beings gracing the window pane, reflecting stillborn images. We're voices chiming in choirs and temples. We're life that won't be forgotten. We're here, and we won't go away. We're the world shiver. It's cold out here. And whether you recognize it or not, we're coming inside. That's like literally the happiest poem I'm going to do tonight. Okay. Let's try to do like a not so serious one. So I'm on Twitter and Facebook and Tumblr and Instagram. I'm not on Snapchat because I'm 33. I feel like it's creepy. So, like, past the limit. No Snapchat for you. Okay, there's like a lot of like Twitter revolutionaries, and like I like radical people. That is awesome. But this, like, you'll know who I'm talking about. This is more like the person that's like in their parents' basement, like shouting. Don't be a that's the theme of this poem. But it's not to say that on Facebook and Twitter, on Tumblr and elsewhere, that there aren't awesome conversations and activism and the utilization of these tools. I mean, I use them because I believe in them. But at the same time, you know, it's like when we talk about Egypt, for example, most of the Egyptians that I know in 2011 didn't have Twitter accounts. And for that to be kind of like the basis of things. But I'd like to preface this, but this is about like a very specific annoying person. You'll know who the I'm talking about. If this is you, stop doing this. You're not that badass. You're not so cool because you regurgitate France Fanon behind a computer screen. You read the same two books everyone else did. It is noticeable. Stop it. You are not above the petty if you were tweeting, I am above the petty if you were, you would probably stop Twitter policing everyone and start working on non-petty if you say things like, I don't tweet for followers, you probably tweet for followers. It is obvious. Stop it. You are not an expert on everything. I get that you vacation for 2 weeks in Egypt, love falafel, and have your very own Huffington Post blog account with 7 million other people, but that is not expertise or due diligence. If you can't point to the country you are tweeting about on the map, you should probably shut the up. Not everything is Iraq. Not everything is Palestine. The only thing that is Nazi Germany is Nazi Germany. Stop with the comparisons, white guy shouting at a demo. You are being unhelpful. And if you think I'm an a**, by the end of this poem, it's probably true, because this is technically a I'm above the penny poem. But seriously, I am. Critiquing shouldn't become the goal, a game, a life, like Candy Crush and Angry Birds and other games I'm not cool enough to know about. Twitter has never been and will never be the revolution. Yes, I tweeted a few times about Miley Cyrus twerking, or her lack of twerking, or her awkward racism, or why so few people initially focused on how creepy Robin Thicke is. See, there, I said it, I'm not above it. But at some point, we have to realize our rubbernecking is slowing down traffic. Movements move. Activists extend beyond 140 characters. We are not the main characters. Many of us are in the belly of the beast, challenging empire with privilege. So stop wearing your intellectual sunglasses at night and build beyond the next soundbite. Appreciate that what we say and do and how we say and do it matters. The best critic isn't the one simply wagging the finger the hardest. Yoda was chill. You should try to be more like him. I'm going to end this poem now. You should totally follow me on Twitter. Okay. I cannot do this next poem, and it's should be self-explanatory enough. During 2008 and 2009, 1,400 Palestinians were massacred in 22 days. Thousands of homes were struck. An open-air prison was decimated. And so I wrote a poem called The Poem for Gaza. So I'm going to perform it tonight. Oddly, 6 years later, it's sad that I would have to do so. And I don't need to talk too much about what happened in July and August. Over 50 days, 2,150 Palestinians were massacred. Over 10,000 people were injured. There was the shelling of hospitals, schools, mosques, UN buildings, and shelters. There was the killing of men, women, and children in the middle of the night. As somebody mentioned before, we're about to enter a very harsh winter. You know, I mean, it's funny when folks talk about how there isn't an occupation in Gaza, when Israel controls the air, the border, the sea, the imports, the exports, every facet of life. Mads Gilbert, who's an internationally renowned doctor and human rights activist, was just banned for life. Folks from the UN were denied entry. And I think that Israel's biggest fear is truth, right? We have a media in the United States. But, you know, we're also an empire, so empires get along, and we're a settler colonial state. So, of course, we get along with apartheid states. We got along swimmingly with South Africa, as did Israel. So, you know, we don't want to let U.S. imperialism and empire and settler colonialism off the hook, even when we talk about what Israel is doing. So this next piece is called A Poem for Gaza, and it's pretty self-explanatory. I never knew death until I saw the bombing of a refugee camp. Craters filled with disfigured elbows and splattered torsos, but no sign of a face. The only impression, a fading scream. I never understood pain until a seven-year-old girl clutched my hand, stared up at me with soft brown eyes waiting for answers. I didn't have any. I had dry pens in my back pocket that couldn't fill pages of understanding or resolution. In her other hand, she held the key to her grandmother's house. But I couldn't unlock the cell that caged her older brothers. They said, we sing shop dreams so the other side will feel our father's presence. A craftsman built homes in areas where no one was building, and when he fell, he was silent. A 50-caliber bullet tore through his neck, shredding his vocal cords too close to the wall. His hammer must have been a weapon. He must have been a weapon. Encroaching on settlement hills and demographics, so his daughter studies mathematics. Seven explosions times eight bodies equals four congressional resolutions. Seven Apache helicopters times eight Palestinian villages equals silence and a second Nakba. Our birth rate minus third birth rate equals one sea and 400 villages re-erected. One state plus two peoples. And she can't stop crying. Never knew revolution or the proper equation. Tears at the pages with her fingertips, searching for answers but only has teachers. Looks to the sky and sees Stars of David demolishing squalor with hellfire missiles. She thinks back words and memories of his last hug before he turned and fell. Now she pumps dirty water from wells while settlements divide and conquer. And her father's killer sits beachfront with European vernacular. She thinks back words while they think back words of obscene notions and indigenous confusion. This is our land, she said. She's 7 years old. This is our land, she said. And she doesn't need history books or a schoolroom teacher. She has these walls, this sky, her refugee camp. She doesn't know the proper equation, but she sees my dry pens. No longer waiting for my answers, just holding her grandmother's key, searching for ink. This next poem is called An Open Letter to Campus Zionist Groups and University Chancellors. It is a love poem. You know, I mean, there's a lot of people on campus, and it's like, we need to have dialogue, and it's like, we need to go eat some of that hummus together on a table, get together, and look, smash apartheid walls. It doesn't actually work like that. Now, I don't care what your gender is, your sexuality, your religion, where you were born. If you're, like, standing against systems of oppression, I can get down with that. But there's been a co-optation of the term dialogue, right? It's not actually about dialogue, because we're going to have a Q&A afterwards and we're going to engage in discussion. But it really is about reaffirming systems of domination, right? People want domination. They don't actually want dialogue. So when there are right-wing initiatives on campus, whether sponsored by a group or your administration or sponsored by an Israeli institution, this isn't about creating conversation. This is about reaffirming structures of oppression, and we should really call that out for what it is. Because for me, I'm down for conversation, but I'm not down to affirm oppression. Okay. This conversation is a dialogue. My Facebook post, that comment back, the email chain, the article in response to the article, the soon-to-be Q&A, the debate in the quad, yesterday's phone call, that time I smiled, said hello, and held the door for a member of Bruins for Israel. You know where we can't have any kind of dialogue? In Palestine. Because I'm not allowed to return. Because ethnically cleansed Palestinians aren't allowed to return. Because ethnically cleansed Palestinians returning would put ethno-religious supremacy in jeopardy. It's easy to talk about your comfort level when there isn't a checkpoint stopping us from meeting, no wall blocking tonight's event from happening. I don't get to get mad at you afterwards and drop white phosphorus on your dorm room if our chat doesn't go well. So let's have a thought experiment on your tolerance. Would Hillel, J Street, Olive Tree Initiative, One Voice, and Seeds of Peace come to a meeting to dialogue on whether or not Jews should have equal rights in America? Whether or not Jews should be stuffed into internment camps in America? Whether or not Jews should face checkpoints before coming onto campus in America? No! You wouldn't want to come to that meeting because it sounds like obscene white supremacist now, doesn't it? This situation is about as two-sided as drowning puppies in a bathtub. Israel is the aggressor, the occupier, the ethnic cleanser, and dominating force from the river to the sea. So don't ask me to indulge racism. That is not dialogue. That is not moving things forward. That is the status quo. That's the bomb's blast. That is the silence of solitary confinement. The academy in America was built on white supremacy, and I'm not looking to replicate the process. You want to hug over justice? I'll stretch my arms and fingertips so wide my knees buckle. But I saw you read a prepared question off your Android, prepped by Stand With Us, given talking points to derail the discussion. You don't want dialogue. You want domination. And that's not something I can offer you. Most administrations don't care about climate. They care about donors and empty email boxes. Houses made of sand willing to crumble at the first sight of rain. Overbloated salaries and egos. Over-anxious trigger fingers willing to throw as many black and brown bodies under the bus as need be. So Chancellor X, challenge us. Student Council Y, let your backbone fold on itself. Administrator Z, tell me about climate while artillery shells eviscerate natives you never cared to learn about. Because students are coming. And they aren't stopping, cowering, caving to veiled threats, stripped funding, and attacks on their organizations. You made a miscalculation. The road to freedom is not through the academy, but these students, armed with more passion than donor funding lining your pockets, are sure as hell gonna smash your roadblocks. There's 48 three-line poems in the book, split up into four different sections, each one to signify one of my displaced grandparents in 1948. This was written a while ago, but there was an Israeli soldier that was held captive in Gaza, and it speaks to that. In Gaza, an Israeli soldier remains in prison. The world knows his name and the conditions to set him free. 7,700 Palestinians wallow in Israeli dungeons. The world cannot mention their names because it never bothered to learn them. For anybody that's familiar with the massacre on Lebanon in 2006, where more than 1,000 Lebanese civilians were killed, there was this iconic image of two little Israeli girls riding on missiles, and they were writing a message with love. And those missiles were then used against the civilian population of Lebanon. Missiles said, "With love, I fall to where they hit. Charred limbs, stained tears, rotting corpses. No love in sight." She closes her eyes, smells the sea salt, takes in a deep breath, and feels the wind hug her arms as her father once did. For a split second, she imagines they've returned, where she was born, where she belongs. So I'm going to end with this piece called Normalize This. Now, there's a video of me of this online in 5 t-shirts that don't fit me all that well. Kind of running around like a fool, so you can check that out. So this is called Normalize This. And for anybody that doesn't know what normalization or anti-normalization is, normalization is quite literally the bringing together of Israelis and Palestinians in a non-anti-apartheid format without making any distinction between occupier and occupied, oppressor and oppressed, those implementing a system of apartheid, and those forced to live under. You see some of the groups, Seeds of Peace, which works in Palestine and also internationally. Again, this is about challenging institutions, state governments, and funding streams that aren't actually trying to bring people together to fight against injustice, but to normalize occupation, to rebrand Israel. So sometimes you'll see groups from like the West Bank, they'll meet up in Tel Aviv, Israeli kids will come. They'll meet up in Jerusalem. Israeli kids will come from Tel Aviv, and it's like, do you like hummus? I like hummus. Oh my God, that's so weird. Let's watch some movies and enjoy summer camp. Now, when you talk to the Palestinian kids who have been in these programs, they'll say, look, it never stopped one bomb from dropping, one settlement expanding, or one bullet from being fired. And more often than not, what ends up happening is that the same people that we're having our awesome summer camp with are the ones dropping the bombs, are the ones manning the checkpoints, are the ones that are protecting children, that are protecting settlers as they throw stones and attack our brothers and sisters and family members. So this is called normalize this. Nothing is normal about occupation. Nothing normal about apartheid, ethnic cleansing, siege, blockade, settler-only roads, bombing water wells, schools, mosques, and UN buildings. Nothing normal about putting a civilian population on a diet, paying non-indigenous colonizers to settle land that is already populated, rewriting the Nakba with each stolen childhood, trying to desensitize the bullet holes and claw marks put into the bodies of Bassem Abu Rahmeh and Rachel Corey. No, I don't want to normalize with you. I don't want to hug, have coffee, talk it out, break bread, sit around the campfire, eat s'mores, and gush about how we're all the same. I don't want to share the stage, co-write a poem, submit to your anthology, talk about how art, instead of justice, can forge a better path. I don't want to indulge your amnesia about a glorious past. Have a therapy session on two sides with equal grievances. The only thing barren is your moral capacity. Blooming a settler colonial state with appropriated culture, I will not fight for your privilege, nor will I seek to normalize it. Your dialogue group, it's a breeding ground for injustice. Just look at the board members and the ZOA sponsorship. Zionism is a real demographic threat, infecting the minds of millions with racism. They were hooded in the South, pushing darker nations into Bantustans, jailing young men in H blocks in Northern Ireland. In case you missed the hint, I don't want to pretend all is okay, or that bombs dropped on Gaza don't have a manufacturer, the pilot doesn't have a nationality, or somehow Shimon Peres is any different than Avigdor Lieberman. It's not just the occupation. It's the right of return, equality for all Palestinians. It's a transformation from a racist, exclusivist, supremacist state to a nation for all of its citizens. You deserve nothing, nothing more than equality, which means more than African refugees are provided in South Tel Aviv. You are the shining light on a settlement hill, reminding the world that racism often comes in nice packaging. Guess what? We don't give the Sudan $3.4 billion a year in military aid. Don't have preferential trade agreements with North Korea. Don't call Iran a democracy. Israel, you're a proxy for empire, a 1950s ethnocracy trapped in 21st century clothing. Yes, you're singled out with aid, weapons, and UN vetoes in your favor. Did I hurt your feelings? Should we hug after the show? Do these words hurt more than, I don't know, bombs dropped on Gaza, white phosphorus eating the flesh of children? I am not the bad guy. You're defending the bad system. Your words and actions have consequences. You're either with oppression or you're against it. I didn't write history and sure as hell didn't choose for you to stand on the wrong side of it. Your system of oppression, it is coming to an end. And whether you recognize it or not yet, it'll be liberating for you too.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. That was One Land, Many Voices. And we heard a talk by Remy Kanazi, a Palestinian-American performance poet and human rights activist who spoke at Portland State University on divestment on school campuses. Again, you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre at 10:15. Hear Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher hosts a panel discussion with presenters from the Mathematics Education and Society Conference, a biennial international conference being held this week at Portland State University, exploring social, political, cultural, and ethical dimensions of mathematics education. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
Attention KBOO members and listeners. The KBOO Foundation is seeking to fill four upcoming vacancies on the Board of Directors. Terms run 3 years, beginning on October 1st. The nomination packet, due July 11th, is posted on the KBOO website and paper copies are available at the station. Candidates must submit the completed nomination packet via email to kboocommunity@gmail.com or mail or drop off the completed nomination packet, care of Timothy Welp, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Incomplete forms will not be considered as fulfilling the statement of interest requirement by the KBOO bylaws. Packets are due by Saturday, July 11th. The candidate statements submitted as part of the nomination packet will be posted to KBOO's website, and candidates will be expected to participate in an interview for broadcast and a Q&A session at the end.